Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's February 14th, 2016, and welcome to episode 120 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. I am Earl Evans, your host with the most, and I am joined by our regular irregulars. Let's go around the somewhat rectangular table today and introduce folks. We'll start over easterly of here. Mr. Ken Gagne, how are you, sir?
Hello, Earl. I'm fine. Happy Valentine's Day.
And to you, also.
Why, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be spending the day with the ones I love the most, that, of course, being my old computers.
Yes, excellent. And so tell me, I hear tell that you might be having a rather cold Valentine's Day out there in Massachusetts.
Are you referring to my cold, dark, dead heart?
No, this is the weather. We could talk about your cold, dead heart some other time. I suspect, you know, that is a conversation we need to have.
Well, yes, it just so happens that the temperature matches my soul today.
And what would that temperature be?
Bleak.
Okay, fair enough. Also in Massachusetts, because it's just a great place for retro computing, Mr. Paul Hagstrom.
Hello.
Hi, Paul.
Happy Valentine's Day, all.
And to you as well, sir. So I suspect your weather is rather the same as Ken's.
Yeah, it is. It's very, very cold. I think all of the Arctic air has come straight down to us.
So. Yikes! Wow. Well, let's reach out to a section of the world that probably is enjoying warmer weather. Michael Mulhern, our representative from Australia, where it is not winter but summer. Hello, Michael.
Good morning, everybody. Yes, it's quite warm down here, expecting to be in the mid-30s for Valentine's Day. That's in Celsius, so roughly converted to... Ken, you're good with numbers. What's that in Fahrenheit? Let's just say 35, so...
35, that'd be about 100
yeah.
Fahrenheit.
So, warm.
Wow.
Warm, very warm.
Okay, well, we've got some extremes.
Yeah, with 100% humidity, just to make it that little bit more enjoyable.
Yikes. Well, all of you make me happy to be in Portland, where it's going to be, I think, around 50 today, Fahrenheit. So
oh, that's nice.
I think I'm splitting the difference. It is looking like another rainy day, but that's the price we pay for all of our trees. So it is Valentine's Day, and as a result, we want to talk about love. Let's talk about love. And specifically, loving retro computing. Do we heart retro computing? I think we do. And that's why we're here. And, you know, when you think about this, I've often referred to the first retro computer that I worked with as a first love. So let's talk about our first love, our current love, and maybe a secret love. Are you cheating on your favorite retro computer? Do you program on the side? And if you do, now's the time to get that off your chest and get it out in the open. So we'll go in the same order. Ken, let's start with you. I suspect that your first love, current love, are possibly the same. What would you say?
With only slight variations, my first love was, as far as computers go, the Apple IIe. So that was the very first machine I remember using, and we used that for about 6 or 7 years before we upgraded, if you can call it that, to a 2GS, which I was very happy to have, and in my view it was an upgrade, because we did all the same things we did with it on the Apple IIe, and in fact used it as essentially an accelerated 2E for years before I started connecting to CompuServe and discovering all the games and utilities that were available in their file libraries that I could download and run, which had not previously been possible on the 2E. And those downloads required some significant hardware upgrades. I got myself a SCSI card with a hard drive and a zip accelerator and a sound card, lots and lots of new toys until this computer that I share with my father, he decided that I had added so much to it that it had gone from being his computer to being mine. And so he went and bought another Apple IIgs that I was not allowed to upgrade so that he could actually know how to use it.
Now, what about the secret love, though?
The secret love, well, I'll give you a secret, but though it's no love of mine, which is that very, very briefly in my high school years, we were a two-platform household. I had both an Apple IIgs and a DOS box. And that was because most of the files that were being uploaded to the BBS I was running on my Apple II were DOS files, and I wanted a platform to test them out on. And this did not last long. I had a couple of switch boxes so that it would share the monitor and maybe even the modem with the Apple II, but it was just a clunky setup, and I didn't like any of the software I was running. I think I got rid of it and tried replacing it with a PC transporter, but that was even clunkier. I don't know where that PC transporter is now. I may have given it to Eric Shepard, or I gave him the manual. I gave him one of them. I don't remember which. But anyway, so yeah, I did not love the PC experience, and I've never gone back. I've been an Apple household ever since.
Wow. Remarkably consistent. I admire that.
I'm no flip-flopper.
Excellent. Well, Paul, what about these three? Your first love, your current love, maybe your secret love. Do you have, you know, an Amstrad that you're not telling us about?
Well, yeah, I think, I don't know. Yeah, it's hard to categorize this exactly, but I pretty much started out on the Apple II, and so that has kind of remained, throughout, I would say, you know, first love, probably, you know, current love as well. That's the one they sort of know the best. And I'm mainly speaking of Apple II prior to 2GS. The 2GS still seems like a weird alien to me. But, I started out junior high school era with a 2+, but in sort of late, just heading into high school, I took a programming job, and so that gave me an opportunity to use PCs, because this was it was a shop that used PCs and Epson QX10s, so that was where I had experience with those. And I remember thinking, so I don't think I loved the PC, but I remember thinking it was quite cool in its just sort of in the design of its drivers and things like that. It was possible to modularly load things in a way that the Apple II didn't. So it seemed like it was sort of another step up in the architecture of the system, at least. So I liked that fact, and I did a little bit of system programming of drivers and things, and I kind of liked that, and I felt a little bad about liking that. So maybe that counts as a secret love. But I really liked the QX10, though. That was, it was a weird place that I worked. It was actually a hotel, so the check-in stuff and all the back-end payroll and stuff was done on the QX10, and I was given one to just do development on at home. And what I mainly really did was use the 1200 baud modem I had to call BBSs, because it was faster than anything I had on my Apple II. So, but I probably am one of the only people that have sort of like played with a QX10 sort of regularly, just sort of set on my bed.
Interesting. And so, just out of curiosity, did you use the Peachtree financial software with the QX10?
Oh, it was the stuff that we did at work was all pretty much programmed in-house in DBase.
Oh, custom.
Yeah.
Custom stuff. Okay.
So no, it was basically the only things I really used. I think I wrote a VBS in, I don't know, it was probably M Basic. Is that a thing?
Mm-hmm.
But
it is.
But most of it was DBase 2 programming.
Okay. Yeah, I did my share of DBase 2 on the QX10 also. When I was working over there at Epson, we needed some software that would be like a reference database for our technical documents. And so we put that together. They called it Technicall.
Nice.
Nerds and their puns. So, well, what about you, Michael? What would you say fits into these three categories?
Well, my first love would have been, I'm trying to remember the actual model, but basically it was when I learnt to do Fortran programming on punch cards and sliding it into the operations area to be run. So that was my first love. My first ever hands-on experience with computers. Until then, it had always just been spinning tape, blinking lights, and things like that in movies. So this was my first almost hands-on, I suppose, at the distance of a glass window where the punch card receipt officer was. But then I quickly moved on to the Apple II Euro Pluses up in the School of Business, and that's where I really got stuck into programming, and that's the machine that I wrote my first program on that I actually got paid for. So that was back in 81, I think. So I've been earning my money on programming computers for a while now. But so I'd say it's Apple II Euro Plus or punch card machine, because I wasn't really using the computer, I was using the punch card machine. But that'd be my first. And my current love would still be my Apple IIc computer. I bought that back in 84, still have it. I've got the monitor and the printer that I bought with it. Then I bought the external 3.5-inch drive and 5.25-inch drive back then in the day, and have just recently started buying more peripherals for it. So it still has my attention. So it's good to have that here on my desk. Actually, just to the left of me as we're doing this podcast is my Apple IIc. So it's managed to come out and have pride of place on my workspace downstairs here in the 8-bit bunker.
For those of us up in North America, that's the right.
No, that's it's upside down. So,
oh,
so yeah, so you know, everything's now just suspended from the floor and pointing southwards. So that's why we have Velcro.
Secret love?
My secret love.
What about the secret love?
Secret love. That'd be a VZ300.
Ah.
So
is that one of the Dick Smith?
One of the Dick Smith
computers?
VZ300s. That's one of the other little things I'm currently working on, getting it hooked up to a VGA monitor. Got a composite out, so I'm going to try hooking it up to there. But it's a machine that I only briefly used. First saw it, obviously, in a Dick Smith electronics store, but by that time I had already started purchasing floppy disks to use the Apple IIs up at the School of Business, School of Science computer lab at Griffith University. So I didn't sort of want to start buying my own hardware at that stage. I've got one now, and I've got a couple of VZ200s, which I've acquired a little while ago, but the 300 seems like quite a nice machine, and that's something which I want to dabble in a little bit on the side, so amongst all my other projects on the side, but that one's got my attention at the moment.
Very good. Excellent. Well, for me, my first love was the Apple II Plus, and I started off with the Fortran coding, but it was difficult. We had a two-day turnaround from when we would submit our batch jobs to when we would get some results back, and it's hard to bond with a machine when it's almost like, you know, transmitting something into outer space. You have to wait a long time to get your responses back. And when our instructor brought in his Apple II and let us bang on it, which I thank him for to this day, then the clouds parted and the light shone through and the angels sang. And I said, wow, this is amazing. This interactive computing, what a concept. My current love is the Commodore 128. I make no bones about this. I think it's the finest 8-bit system ever produced. It's a triple personality and has a really nice keyboard and a great 80-column display, and I just love it. Love that thing to death. But secret love, that's maybe a little more interesting. I don't talk about this a lot, but I have a small collection of 90s-era Unix workstations. And I think those are just the coolest thing. I've got an UltraSpark and a HP 9000 C110 workstation that runs HP UX, and also an SGI Indigo 2 that runs Irix. And in the 90s, they were serious when they built these Unix workstations. You almost get a hernia picking one of these things up. They're amazingly heavy, built to last. I turn them on these days and they fire up just as smoothly as they did when they were brand new. And the power of that Unix operating system, back when I actually used these in the mid-90s, they were a gajillion dollars, and now they're not, and they're still fun to play around with. But anyway, I don't mention that a heck of a lot, but that's something that I really enjoy. And so there you go. So now that's all out on the table. And I guess we knew coming in that we loved retro computers, so no big surprise there. But happy Valentine's Day, everyone.
Yay.
So now on to listener feedback. And Paul Hagstrom is the undisputed king of feedback. So I'm going to turn it over to him.
Excellent. Me and what, Pete Townsend or whatever. But yeah, okay, so we have a fair amount of feedback. Some of these may take a while to talk through, but Jeremy wrote to update us on Marvin Minsky, to mention that cryogenic preservation wasn't an option given the circumstances of his death, and we still are unsure about the level of reverence we expressed last time, but at any rate, yes, so... thanks, Jeremy, for setting us straight on that. I think we probably need setting straight on various points there. But
Every now and then, it's all right.
Okay. Tony pointed us to an article at the Computer History Museum that highlighted a press conference that was 60 years ago today, as we record, so Valentine's Day, 1956, which effectively launched the silicon-based semiconductor industry. William Shockley and Arnold Beckman spoke there, and I read through this article, and it was, I find it not entirely clear what it was that was happening, but I think they were basically looking for investors to sort of start this project together, investigating transistors and silicon and, you know, sort of leading the way toward making chips. Did anyone have a chance to look at this?
I didn't, but it sounds interesting.
Yeah, I think it makes me want to learn a little more about what was going on there. But at any rate, there's some nice photos, and it's a nice, you know, point in history to point to.
There's a documentary about back in those days, and you can actually find it on Netflix. But for the life of me, I can't think of the name of it. But I'll try and look it up, because it covers a lot of that early Silicon Valley history with the invention of the microchip and that. Let me see if I can find that and put it in the show notes. Or if somebody just knows, you know, just let us know. But I found it to be a really nicely done documentary.
It looks like Gordon Moore and Robert Noyce were, you know, working alongside him, at least alongside Shockley, maybe also alongside Beckman too. Beckman, I know the Beckman name from those resistor packs or whatever they are that you see on circuit boards. I assume that's the same Beckman. But very, very prominently, it just says Beckman. Anyway, no one is chiming in to say, oh, yes, I know what you're talking about. So maybe I'm just making this up. But Andy wrote in to let us know that Kansas Fest 2016 registration is now open. We announced, I think we've talked about Kansas Fest pretty much every single episode that there has been in the last however many years RCR has been running. But the registration for 2016 is now open, so head over to there and sign up.
I already have. Has anybody else?
I have not, but I will. How about you, Michael?
I haven't got round to doing it yet because I need to just sort out a few bits and pieces here, but I'd say more likely I will be going again this year. Would really like to select, see if I can do some other vintage computer festivals while I'm traveling, because as much as I loved flying up to the US last year for Kansas Fest, you know, you're spending just under 24 hours traveling in each direction. It'd be sort of nice to sort of drop in to some other along the way. So I'm once I can confirm the time that I've got available either side of Kansas Fest, I want to have a look to see if there are any other festivals on, what museums or exhibitions I could possibly visit on my way rather than flying straight into Kansas City. But that's planning. So the short answer is not yet.
Okay. Excellent. Let's see. Bob wrote a couple things here. So one is he pointed out that the Mountain View Computer History Museum is saying goodbye to one of its most unique exhibits. It was on loan. It was the Babbage engine, and that is no longer. The loan period is up. So there's a little article about that and how they, you know, how they sort of bade it farewell. So it was.
Where is it going?
I think it's going back to the owner for a private collection.
Oh.
Yeah.
I was fortunate enough to be able to see it back in December on the day that they were celebrating the birthday of Ada Lovelace.
Ah, nice.
Yeah, I happened to be in the neighborhood visiting Mr. Martin Hay, GCS staff writer and author of Structurus, and we had some time to kill, so we went over there, and it happened to be a holiday, and they were all in sort of a... They had a steampunk motif going that day, which was a lot of fun, and they showed the Babbage machine in action.
That would be cool to see, yeah.
If it's going to Seattle, but it's going to be locked away, which is kind of a bummer because that's a short drive for me and I'd love to see it.
Yeah. Yeah, apparently January 31st was the last day that it was there in at the Computer History Museum. But, oh well, it was great that it was at least viewable until then. So,
mm-hmm.
Let's see, Bob also wrote to point out a pretty interesting little article. It's not. It wasn't recently posted. It was about maybe a year ago. This was. So what's the guy's name? Karsten Ton Petersen in Denmark had rediscovered a sort of a, what is this thing? It's a heavily modified AIM-65 that he put a video display on and a module cage and a keyboard and some a switchable fourth basic ROM in, and it's really just pretty much an AIM-65. With everything added into it to make it a kind of a nice computer slash test bed for cards and things. And so he found it, he plugged it all in, it worked, and he wrote up his notes on, you know, how he constructed it and what it did. And it's a neat project. The AIM-65 is one of these single board computers, I think it was a 6502 on it. So it's a... Yeah, not very long, but it has some nice pictures, and it's just an interesting project that would be really fun to do, but wow, that must have taken a lot of time. Anyway, take a look at that. And let's see, we got Blake commented over Twitter. We had talked about how to deal with information overload, and I guess his comment wasn't so much about how to deal with the overload, but how to continue to aggregate information. He points out that he makes... a lot of use of RSS feeds from blogs, which is something that I used to do, and I really have kind of stopped paying attention to that. I think I may want to try to go back to doing that. Is that something you guys do? Am I alone in falling out of the RSS habit?
No, I do the exact same thing, actually. I'll go on a little RSS kick where I'm pretty regular with reading my RSS feeds, and I'll find some sort of an aggregator that I use, and then that'll either get old or go away or something like that, and I'll wave off for a while, and then I'll come back to it. It just kind of goes in seasons. One of the things that I really liked was the Google aggregator, and when that went away, that bummed me out, seriously. So I don't think I've swung back to it really as regularly as I used to.
Since Have you then. Tried Feedly?
Yeah, I did. I didn't like it as much.
Yeah, I think Google pulling the reader was a pretty big blow, I think, to the RSS community. But when that went away, I did myself try. What am I using? NewsBlur, and you know, so it's actually a premium thing, and I decided, all right, I'm going to commit to this, and I paid for it, and then ignored it for about 2 years or whatever, however long it's been. But just a couple days ago, I started it up again and just tried to tailor things and add some new blogs in, and so we'll see. Maybe that's I do kind of like that because it at least does keep on the radar people's individual postings, you know, so even if it's not something that makes it to one of the bigger, you know, rebroadcast sites.
I have a spreadsheet with about probably 100 Apple II related RSS feeds on it, and every now and then I go through and I update them to see which ones are still relevant. Sometimes it's just the Apple II tag on a much larger blog like Gizmodo, which has its own RSS feed. But so there are 64 on there right now, and I used to put all these into a Yahoo Pipes feed. Mm-hmm. Yahoo Pipes is this tool that you can use to manipulate and combine and edit the data coming through an RSS feed and output it to a new RSS feed. So I had one RSS feed that you could subscribe to that would get all 64 of these feeds. But Pipely, or whatever it's called, Yahoo Pipes, started choking on that many feeds being fed into it. And I even had some Apple II users asking me to remove their feeds from this pipe. I don't know why. And also, Yahoo Pipes wasn't necessarily preserving information about where the feed was coming from on the other end. So you would see the headline, but you'd have to click through to the original blog to see actually who wrote it, which is of limited utility, in my opinion. So I still keep the RSS list, just out of curiosity to know what blogs and websites are out there. But I generally need to subscribe to each one individually, which is a pain in the butt. But you know, once you do that in Feedly once, you just create an Apple II folder, and you open that up, and it's basically the same thing as having a single RSS feed, because it just lists everything aggregated. So it's still pretty handy.
Of course, Yahoo Pipes also closed.
Did it?
Yeah.
I'm not surprised. Yahoo does that. Oh, yeah. You go to Google and it says Yahoo Pipes was a web application.
Yep.
It doesn't say when it closed, though. It just says that it's now defunct. Oh, on June 4th, 2015, it was announced that Pipes would be read-only and would shut down on September 30th, 2015. Oh, just 3 months ago. Wow. Okay. Thanks for that update. I'm glad I stopped using it.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the thing that actually has made it sort of difficult for me to decide, you know, how do I want to post my scans and, you know, all these things, or how do I want to commit to RSS? What platform do I want to use for RSS reading? Because everything, I invest a bunch of time into setting one up and then it closes.
Indeed.
So annoying. Let's see, last bit of feedback we actually just got today. Tony sent a link to an article from February 2014 in the Register, which is pretty interesting. I don't think we mentioned it before. It's possible that we linked to it at some point in the past, but it has some discussion of what was going on at Sinclair, right, basically as they got acquired by Amstrad. And so prototypes that never saw the light of day, some getting a little further than others, but talking about the low-cost color computer, and there's something called the Loki, and this weird little portable thing called the Pandora, which actually was going to have a little CRT in it and a laptop form factor. Apparently Sinclair had some kind of 2-inch CRT they could use. So anyway, it's actually super detailed. I mean, like, I didn't read every word of it because there's three long pages of this, but pretty interesting to look at, particularly if you know something about the Sinclair lineage.
Neat. Yeah, So the things that would get cooked up in the R&D labs of these companies, sometimes they were really interesting. One link that we might also want to put to go along with this is a site called the Secret Weapons of Commodore. I might have mentioned it in the past, but it's an extremely detailed write-up on a lot of computer models that never made it out of Commodore Skunk Works, but some of them were interesting, innovative, or just plain weird. So I'll try and find that and put that in there too. But yeah, these companies, when they would do this R&D stuff, I'm amazed at the amount of money that had to go into some of the research and development only to just squash it and never actually release it. Anyway, over to items of interest. And thank you, Paul, for covering all that feedback. We had quite a bit, and we love to get the feedback, so keep it coming. In the news this time around, one thing that I wanted to talk about, I found this on the cpcwiki.eu forum, a forum about Amstrad systems, and this post covered cross-development from modern computers targeting the Amstrad, but using very innovative technology. I don't know if I've ever talked about this before on the show, but there is a containerization type technology called Docker. You could think of it as like a really lightweight virtual machine, but it doesn't have all of the OS goo that normally comes with a virtual machine. It's just the application that you want. So you could put a simple web server inside a Docker container and launch it really quick, or a database inside a Docker container and launch it really quick. You get all the configuration and the code and the software and everything that you need to light up a platform really fast. So in this case, they took a tool chain, set of tools for cross-development for the Amstrad, and they put it in a Docker container. Now, you can really easily use this if you're on Linux. It's something that's very simple to install. The nice thing about it is Windows also supports Docker containers now. It's a little bit more work to get it set up, but once you do, then you can take these Docker containers. It's all the rage. It's, you know, what the kids are doing these days out on the street corners. They're using the Docker containers. And I thought this was cool and innovative and makes it really easy to set up your cross-development environment. And the person who set this up, I think, actually wrote some Amstrad demos, and that they're also covered in this forum posting. And I went over and I watched some of one of the demos on YouTube, and it was amazing. So kudos to these folks for merging the old and the new in an innovative way. And also, we'll have a link just to the top level on the cpcwiki.eu forum also. If you're an Amstrad enthusiast, might not be a bad stopover point on the internet for you. So now over to Ken. Ken, you got some freebies, and I looked at these. These are great.
Yeah, these are a series of books published by, would it be pronounced Osborne? Anybody else know?
I don't know.
Okay, well, this was a book publisher, and by was, I mean is a book publisher in the UK, which 30 years ago, just as they are today, were publishing books aimed at elementary and grade school students, and they released a series of books about programming with such wonderful titles as Programming Tricks and Skills, Practical Things to Do with a Microcomputer, Making Your First Fantasy Games and Adventure Games, Computer Fun and Simple Basic, about 15 books in total. And just recently, Osborne released all 15 of these classic books as free PDFs. Now, they are still copyrighted by Osborne, and you are not allowed to distribute or sell the books, but you are welcome to go to their website and download the PDFs. Now, these are primarily for computers that were popular in the UK, so you're not going to find a lot of Apple II native code in here. More likely, it's going to be for the ZX Spectrum, BBC Micro, and Commodore 64. And lest modern computer users be confused about this, there is a disclaimer on the website. The programs will not run on modern computers. Now, of course, the disclaimer to the disclaimer is, unless you have an emulator, but they didn't bother going quite into that level of detail. However, if you check out the books, they're a lot of fun to look at and to read. These are not just the sort of plain two columns of text that you find in some magazine like Juice.js. This is, looking at one of these books about how to make your own fantasy games, this looks almost like one of the early like Dungeons and Dragons manuals. It's so beautifully laid out with colorful and fun illustrations of like skeletons and goblins and snakes and the kinds of things that you might find in your first fantasy or adventure game. So even if you don't have pangs of nostalgia from having read these as a child, or even if you're not going to be writing your first adventure game on a BBC Micro, head over to usborn.com and take a look at these PDFs. They're a lot of fun.
Yeah, I noticed the layout of the books would really promote some excitement. I mean, you look at these things and they're not just the dull wall of text that you normally see in some of the books from that era. So, golf clap for Usborn for making these things available. I think that that is fantastic.
Yeah, I wish more of these companies would, and I understand just from the fact that they have that disclaimer that there is some cost associated with releasing these PDFs. People always say, oh, you're not using them anymore. Why don't you just release them? Like Apple, you have all this old code, old documentation. Why don't you just release it? Well, the issue is that they haven't always necessarily preserved the original material that they used to make these things. They don't always have the source code, and even if they did, there is a cost associated with assembling, organizing, hosting, and distributing that content. And so for Usborn to put these books up, they're probably going to be getting some queries now about, can I distribute these books? Or how come this book won't work on my computer? Or whatever. And there is a cost associated with answering those queries. Human resources have to be devoted to getting those files up and now maintaining them. So truly, kudos to Usborn for deciding that it was worth it to go through that effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and actually one other thing about these books is that I've seen other books for kids that, you know, have the same kind of cartoon style and layout and you know, are pretty content-free. But these actually these are pretty sophisticated. So, you know, if you can look past the cartoons, you can also get some, like, real information out of these as well.
I just love companies that do things like this. This is great. I hope that as a result of this, that Usborn winds up getting some additional business for their current line of products as well.
Well, I'd never heard of them before this, and we certainly wouldn't be talking about them on this podcast if they hadn't released 30-year-old PDFs. So yep. They are still publishing books for kids, so go check them out.
Mm-hmm. Including Coding for Beginners Using Scratch.
That's right. Yeah,
oh, nice.
Scratch being the MIT language.
Excellent. All right. Well, Michael, it looks like a good old friend might be coming around to visit again. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, for all of us diehard OS2 users, or were diehard OS2 users, Blue Lion is going to be coming back hopefully around third quarter of this year. So if you've been wanting to run OS2 on more modern hardware, or I should say on modern hardware, this release is going to be basically aimed at all the new metal that's out there so that you can continue to run OS2 systems and migrate them over to something that's probably going to last just a little bit longer, or at least not on its last legs. I was a big OS2 user, back in the 90s, back when it was pretty much towards the end of OS2. So I had been using it on and off in the late 80s, but I was a big user of OS2 Warp, so OS2 4. So that was a large chunk of my time with enterprise printing, mainframe connecting to a mainframe and getting all of the print coming off that and spinning that out to network-connected printers. So it's good to see an old friend coming back into the modern day. So it's stepping out of its retro computerness and joining us in our everyday computing, by the looks of it.
I think that's great. I'm wondering what the target market will be for this, what kind of legacy systems that we'll find that people will want to upgrade on more modern hardware with a modern version of OS2. But whatever happens with that, I think it's nothing but a good thing.
I'm just glad to see that there are people who are seriously supporting it. I'd known there'd always been a cult following. There were people who were still bundling up updaters for OS 2 to fix problems and consolidating bits and pieces, but it was still effectively a retro operating system running on slightly retro hardware. It was definitely not current day distribution grade, but it is great to see a enterprise that is seriously looking at getting a new distribution out. As it says, it's Blue Lion to be the next distribution of the 28-year-old OS. So OS2's been around since, about 1985, and then through its various incarnations or releases. And I believe that Warp finished up, 95, 96?
Somewhere there, yeah.
So it's good to, as you said, good to see an old friend coming back out.
You know, these old solid operating systems, they just won't die. Another good example of this is VMS, which had been really stagnant for a decent period of time, but then a company called VMS Software decided to take the ball and run with it and is actually doing that and is porting it to other platforms and continuing to make updates to VMS, and you can find them at vmssoftware.com, but I think it speaks to, this is solid, people had systems running on this that they cared about, and they want to see it continue moving into the future. So, neato. As a security guy, I'm loath to tell anyone to go click on links with viruses. Paul, can you tell us why this is safe?
Well, I can tell you that an expert has said they were safe. Is that close enough?
That'll do. But we trust experts.
Yes, exactly. Pretty recently on the on archive.org, there has been posted a site called the Malware Museum, and this is basically curated, I think, by Mikko Hipponen, who is a longtime Finnish computer security expert whose name I have heard before. So. Presumably, given that, a trustworthy expert. But what it is basically a bunch of malware, viruses and programs that were from the MS-DOS era. So you can sort of see what they've been sort of stripped of their malignancy, but you get to see what happens if they, if they trigger. So it's pretty interesting. There are some examples of one where it'll take control of your computer, and then you basically have to play like a slot machine kind of game to see if you get to keep your data or whether it's going to delete it. there's some other sort of interesting things there, but I didn't live enough in the DOS world to have experienced these, but particularly I think if you ever were fell victim to one, I think it might be interesting to see, or just to see what creative horribleness people made. So it's actually gotten quite a lot of press too. There's an article on Ars Technica that talks through it a bit. And it actually has there was something on the BBC News site as well. It says, an online archive of old computer malware has attracted more than 100,000 visitors since it launched 4 days ago, it said on February 8th. So anyway, yeah, it's worth taking a look at, and I intend to take a further look at it myself, but there are quite a few. So, anyone get bitten by any of these?
I got hit a couple times on our land by something called the Jerusalem virus. Do you guys remember that one? That was an early DOS virus.
Vaguely.
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember exactly. Yeah, we used to have a very vigorous scanning of floppy disks coming into the company, and woe be any user who bought in any of these things. But it's I suppose great reminiscing sort of in to sort of like see these things.
Great in some sense.
Yeah.
We had software called Virex on our DOS machines that would take care of this. And I think that morphed into one of the might have morphed into what's now McAfee, but it was way back in the day. Well, neat. I guess we'll go over there and reminisce about malware back in the day when it wouldn't encrypt all your files and make you pay Bitcoin to get them back.
Right.
Michael, a couple weeks ago, I guess, the Retro Challenge ended. So what happened there?
Well, I suppose there was a large amount of code and frustration. I avoided the frustration this year by not entering, but yes.
I didn't jump in this time either.
You had a better shot at it last time than I did. But okay, enough about me. If you pop over to the competition winners, we'll supply the link. There are some very, very impressive programming exercises here. So they give us the winners in the traditional, in no particular order. But one of my favorites was a retro CIDE. So having a retro challenge project of creating a framework so that other people can do retro programming on modern day bits and pieces. So that was over at Tradener Computes. That was an excellent one. And actually, just after the close of the retro challenge, he incorporated Quinn Dunkey's her GUI that she created for the Apple II using the mouse text. So that's all been incorporated into there to help with programming on that side of things. Some games, some maze games, some porting, and it's quite challenging to actually, I suppose, come up with winners for this, because as well as the four that they've showcased here as the winners, there are some very impressive projects. So if you haven't had the chance to actually see who entered what into the Retro Challenge, and also to get some great ideas of what you can actually do for the next one. So every 6 months, this is run. So run, don't walk, do yourself a favor, and pop over and have a look at our four winners.
I will do so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have not had the time to really read through as people have been putting these things together. But one thing I would also like to do, to the extent that I can, is try to follow along on some of them, you know, where I have the machine that they're using. Mm. Or
and such a range of hardware, too. It's quite interesting that the range of systems that have been programmed on.
Well, all right. Thanks for sharing that. We'll have the link, like all the others, up in the show notes. So we'll be your one-stop shopping center if you want to go take a look at those things. So Ken, Woz gets mad. Is that like American mad or more like Canadian mad? Because Woz just doesn't seem to be, you know, an angry guy.
Well, I don't think Canadians get mad, and Woz wants to be Australian anyway, so. No, he posted an update to Facebook the other day, which made me cower because exactly what you said, Woz is such a lovely gentleman, and to think for even a moment that someone you adore and admire could be mad at you is just heart-wrenching. Fortunately, he wasn't mad at me. So Woz has had some experiences where individuals will ask him to sign a gratuitous number of items, which they will then turn around and flip. And, you know, he has a website. He works with a particular vendor. I think the site is signedbywoz.com. And you know, he'll sign stuff through there and sell it. But when people just catch him coming out of a restaurant or an airport and say, hey, sign all this stuff for me, you know, Woz is such a nice guy that he never says no, even though he's being taken advantage of. And what he was saying on Facebook was that he's not going to do this anymore because these people aren't his friends and he has no reason to let them do this to him. So when
understandable.
No, it's a perfectly valid response, and I think it's a good one for him to take. But when his original post, which he then clarified in the comments on Facebook, made it sound like anyone who would ask him to sign something is no friend of his. And I was like, but you came to Kansas Fest and you signed stuff for me. Does that mean you don't like me anymore?
And, I think he actually mentioned your name.
No. So yeah, it was not aimed at legitimate, authentic fans of Apple, Apple II, Steve Wozniak himself. You know, those people are legit, and the fact that they share a passion and an interest makes them essentially his friends. But people who are just looking to make a buck off his fame, those are not his friends, and those are the people that he was making this declaration to.
Well said. Yeah. And I think it is wrong to take advantage of him in that respect, because he's been so good about reaching out in a friendly way to folks that are interested in Apple and Apple's legacy and coming to things like Kansas Fest. So nice for him to set a little boundary there. I think that's good. So speaking about boundaries, I think there are things that we should run in a web browser, and then there's other things I'm not so sure, Michael.
Well, I think this one comes into the I'm not so sure basket. Okay. So just had talked about OS 2 and how it basically finished up with Warp in 95, 96. Now, the big Microsoft competitor to OS 2 Warp at that stage was Windows 95. Now, Windows 95 created a little bit of furore back in the day. Remember when Microsoft started integrating their Internet Explorer into the operating system, and the European... They got a little bit narky, let's just say, about not having a choice. Well, actually, they did have a choice. It's just that the fact that Internet Explorer was basically being shoved into your face out of the installation. What someone has now done, and I find this quite interesting, is that they've taken DOSBox and they've put Windows 95 into it and bundled it all up. And now it's available for you to click on a link, and you can have a look at Windows 95 running inside your web browser. It's a little bit buggy at the moment, so ironically, if you tried to start up Microsoft Explorer in Windows 95, you're probably going to crash the system out of your web browser, which...
Which is authentic to today's experience with IE.
It is, it is. But I just thought it was quite interesting that someone went to the trouble of bundling up Windows 95 inside DOSBox. I'm sure there's a little bit of intellectual property trespass going on here, because Microsoft is a little hum, cease and desist. But yeah, while it's here, go have a look. It's fun. I just loved it from the point of view that I was able to look at Windows 95 inside my web browser, rather than looking at my web browser from inside my Windows 95.
I don't suppose you could, like, look at it in the web browser in Windows 95 in the web browser.
Ooh, brain hurt. No, just before the show, I was having a look. I've still got on my server here at home all of my little helper programs for when I used to do quite a lot of system emulation. I used to have quite a few Windows 95 instances running on various versions of VMware or... just trying to remember the Windows one, not Windows, the Mac one back in the G3 and G4 days, which ironically Microsoft bought out, which is probably why I can't remember. But all these little helper programs for actually getting Microsoft Internet Explorer for Windows 95 talking with my network here in the office and downstairs here, and able to actually, up to a point in time, actively use the built-in web browser to a Windows 95 client to actually go out and download bits and pieces for that Windows 95 system. I was actually running some font editing software and font manipulation software, which was part of what I needed to get some stuff done. And I'm actually going to see what I can do to get this bundled up version of Windows 95 running, so maybe people can actually then do as you suggested, start up their web browser, start up Windows 95, and then open up the web browser inside their Windows 95, and then see where that takes them.
Oh, that would be hilarious. Well, Paul, tell me that nobody else is trying to do Windows stuff in a browser.
Well, unfortunately, I can do no such thing. but yeah, so if you wanted to step back even a little further, just recently the Internet Archive has announced that there is a software library for Windows 3.x now available. You know, running, you can run. It's like the DOS games, the DOS collection that they had before, but now it is running Windows 3.1, various programs under Windows 3.1. So if you want to check that out, it's actually a very similar setup to the thing that we were just talking about with Windows 95. I believe it's mscript and translated DOSBox that it runs in. But you know, so here too, you can run your Windows 3.1 stuff in a browser, and I have. You know, I've run a couple of things. It does seem to work. I guess I don't have a whole lot. I haven't actually tried much of it, but there's a lot here, and just the fact that it works is interesting in itself. I mean, I think just finding things to try out under this browser would be interesting to do as well. I'm sure I have a pile of disks somewhere with, you know, games that I'd played or whatever. So.
Neat way to relive this.
I'll have to go and have a look to see if they've got Civilization Civ 2 running under this, because whenever I get a new computer, it doesn't matter whether it's Linux, Windows, or a Mac, the first thing I do after I get it all set up and running is install DOSBox or the equivalent, and then I go and install Windows 3.1.1, and then I go and install Civ 2, because Civ 2 is one of my all-time favorite games, and I do actually prefer running it in the Windows 3.1.1 environment rather than getting, say, Civilization Test of Time or any of the slightly later versions and running them natively. So I'm going to have to go have a look at this. I love mm-hmm. playing with old operating systems and sort of nesting them in emulators and whatnot. And if I can sort of play with them in a web browser as well, it sounds great. Yeah, all power to the Internet Archive.
Yeah, they say that they've now added over 1,000 programs that run in your browser in a Windows 3.1 environment. So when I did a search, Civilization didn't bring anything up, but who knows? I'm sure that someone out there has it, and at some point it can make its way up.
Mm.
Well, very neat. Well, I think that concludes our news segment, and so now a quick word from our sponsor.
The Amstrad 464 is the 64K home computer with a monitor and data recorder included. From around $429, only our competitors aren't having fun.
And we're back to talk about the host retro computing gift idea, and this time, again, going with the Valentine's Day theme, I think we want to look at a scarf. And this scarf, one of the other, I have to admit that I borrowed this gift idea from one of the other hosts, but boy, do I like it, especially since it's a Commodore 64 scarf. This is a scarf, but not just any scarf, because it has code on it. Actual source code. So in a sense, this is as open source as you get, actually wearing your source code on your person. They say this amazing wrap scarf features a basic code print combined with the Commodore 64 start screen. And it's chartreuse green on a black scarf, so you can definitely see it. And you're going to get comments. I can't guarantee what the comments will be, but if you wear this, people will notice. And the price is I'd say middle of the road, $48. That's not cheap. That's not super expensive, but you know, it is vegan safe, they say. So there you go.
Nice. Is it? Do you recognize what it does? I'm just trying to read it, and it looks like it's relying on some kind of like a ROM code. So I don't know what the entry point is, but poking things into somewhere around 54272 and doing some sort of byte math.
Gosh, is that the sound chip stuff?
That's what I would have guessed, but
I'm a bad Commodore guy. I don't know that address by heart. Interesting.
So someone needs to get the scarf and type this in.
Yes. This is, I guess, the ultimate in the type-in programs.
I was going to say, that would be typing in the load scarf command.
Yep.
Yeah, save to scarf.
So go scarf that one up. You can find it at shanalogic.com, and we'll have that link up in the show notes. Now more things we can buy. Let's talk about eBay auctions. The best and the brightest on eBay for you. Michael, I don't know what creepy programming means. What does that mean?
I think a lot of languages fall into that one. But no. No. As Ken covered earlier, the Osborne programming books, which are probably slightly out of print, so PDF is a good option. But, of course, you can find almost anything on eBay. So here is a listing for their Creepy Computer Games, their Vintage Creepy Computer Games volume. So it currently has one bid, 99 cents, and relatively cheap shipping for here in Australia. So don't know how that's going to go for someone else, but it's just an example of what you can find. So normally when I see an interesting book, or titles, the first place I pop into is see if I can pick it up on eBay. Normally there are people who are selling off their collections or selling off some other family member's collection. But I then also pop off to other booksellers and whatnot to have a look. But if you're interested in any of these Osborne titles and, like me, you prefer to have something a little bit more physical rather than a PDF, there's an option available here for you.
Nice. It is. Sometimes it is fun to just look at the actual book.
Yeah. It has a inside shot of the Ghost Guzzler game. So that's basically showing, as we mentioned earlier, the artwork and the style. So it's definitely written to get the attentions of the young programmer back in the day. So if this was one of the books that you had back then, maybe this is a good way of getting it back into your nostalgia shelf of your book collection.
I like if you look at that the page, you know, the inside page, there's a the lines of BASIC actually have these little keys next to them, sort of like, you know, the chili pepper or whatever you see on a menu in a restaurant. But and so there's a little star or a little triangle or something that indicates, like, if you're using, you know, some particular flavor of BASIC, then this line has to be this. You know, so if you're using, you know, I think the above listing will work on a ZX81, but otherwise you need to change these lines indicated by the triangle to whatever fits your computer.
On the front cover it says, for the Spectrum, ZX81, BBC, Oric, VIC-20, TRS-80, Apple, Dragon. So, yeah, you're going to have to make changes along the line, along the way as you're programming it, because they're basically giving you, I suppose, they're giving you ideas to start with and to extend. So I remember books like this, And similar ones as they were coming out when the computers were new. And, I just think they're great.
Yeah, I agree. And it's really especially fun because this one has this theme, this little sort of niche theme. So, neat find. Paul, you've got a couple things.
Yeah, so the first one I have come across here is it's a Color S video cable with audio connector for the Commodore 64C, SX64, 128, and 128D, and it's a newly made cable that basically seems to be taking a video out. So I haven't actually looked at the only one of these that I have is an SX64, and I haven't looked to see what the connector is. But what it seems to be doing is basically plugging into the machine and then creating a S video out that you can plug into anything that takes an S video in, and then also the audio. So it looks like it would be pretty useful if you had one of the machines that uses this. I don't think a regular 64 can use it, but looks nice.
Well, some of them I think could. It's just if you have the one that has the connector with the separate chroma and luma outputs, then that actually is, in a sense, very much like S video. So, interesting.
Yeah, it doesn't look like the cable's doing any work. I think it's just connecting pins. But still, it's not super expensive. $11 to buy it now. The next thing I found was, this is a weird-looking thing, which is, it seems to be basically a case that you can put over Sinclair Spectrum. It's basically a full keyboard that you can sort of put your Spectrum inside, I guess, so you don't have to deal with the normal keyboard that it had. So, looks interesting. I've never seen one before. It looks, I wouldn't mind having it just for the way it looks on the outside. It's kind of got a nice color scheme.
It does.
So I don't remember actually what the Spectrum, I think the Spectrum also had one of these flat keyboards, didn't it? The membrane
I think
keyboard.
The original Spectrum did.
Yeah.
So, I can't remember though.
Definitely this would be better than that. another thing I found last night, and put it in the show notes, hoping it might make it, but of course it didn't, was a TI-99-4. So I always keep an eye out for these, just to see if they ever show up, and they just never do. But one did show up, and it got bought within 24 hours. But this is a TI-99-4, so not a 4A. Probably just a terrible computer to use, but still an interesting thing to have because they didn't last very long in the wild.
Quite collectible. Yeah, whenever I see those, they go for a pretty penny. And I checked out the ZX Spectrum, and actually it had one of the squishy rubber keyboards, so it's not a membrane keyboard, but it wasn't a good keyboard either.
Yeah, a cheap one at least, I'm sure. But anyway, so if you want to see evidence that occasionally a TI-99-4 appears on eBay, there is evidence that it does sometimes happen, and if you don't notice it within hours, it's gone. This one sold, it looks like it sold for $320 or possibly a little less. I can't quite tell if the best offer accepted means what it means. The last thing that seemed interesting to me was a Synertec SIM 1 in its box. So it looks basically unused. It's a single board computer 6502 thing. It has a what would not at the time have been an interesting box, but white with blue ink box. It's a SIM, the complete microcomputer system, and has a little price list for various options you can have, and then still in a plastic bag has the SIM 1 board. So looks very nice. It's doesn't actually seem like it's being sold for very much. I mean, I'm not quite ready to spend this myself on it, but it's buy it now for $175, and that seems like it's on the upper edge of probably reasonable for this.
Yes.
So if you hear this and it's still there and you want it, go now.
Cool. Well, and I've got something. You guys know I like terminals, and this is an interesting one. I haven't actually seen this before. It's from the early 80s, from a brand named Direct. And the particular model is a Direct 831. It's a VT100 compatible terminal, and it's a luggable. And the thing that I really like about this is it's in extremely clean condition. The cord is a little yellowed, you can see here in the photos, but as I was looking at this from the various angles, I was amazed, actually, what good condition this was without a lot of yellowing and such. Also, they have a picture of it turned on and working with the status line displaying on the monitor. So that gives me some level of hope that this is actually functional as well as looking nice. And another cool thing is that you can make an offer if you want to. The current price, if you want to buy it now, is $283, which might be that's maybe a tad on the high side for an off-brand terminal, but if that's too high for your taste, then you could make an offer. So I thought this was just a really cool-looking terminal, cool-looking keyboard and that.
Yeah, I really like the color scheme, and it is really clean. It would not be embarrassing to have, displayed.
No, it'd be a neat part of the collection.
Yeah. I see that they have a close-up shot of what I think is evidence that the warranty is void.
Oh!
the quality assurance seal has been broken. But
well, shoot.
Oh, well. Probably okay.
Well, you might want to buy it anyway. I don't even know if the company that made them is still in business.
I don't think I've seen one of these before, but I like it. Very cool.
Yeah. It's a neat thing, all in a luggable case. So for your portable, what would you say, mini computer computing. And that's the end of the eBay auction, so I guess we're into the closing discussion. And just in time, because we're at right about an hour. So let me go around the table here and say, Ken, any parting shots?
Unfortunately, I'm coming out blank, except for, as we said earlier, go and register for Kansas Fest. This is the earliest I can ever recall them having opened registration for the event. Sometimes it doesn't happen until April, and so having 2 additional months of preparation to budget and schedule is an opportunity you should take advantage of. So mark your calendar and come to Kansas Fest in Kansas City, Missouri, this July... What are the dates?
19 to 24, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, that's it. July 19th to the 24th, 2016, and hear Mike Harvey of Nibble Magazine deliver the keynote.
Indeed. Paul, what about you?
Well, let's see. I have been so busy with, like, you know, real world work that I feel like I have gotten very little done, but my plans are basically to stay warm and try to find minutes, I think.
That's a good plan, especially the staying warm part.
Yeah. Old computers are actually not bad at helping out on that score.
No, they will warm up a room, won't they? That is a good thing. So, Michael, what about you?
Well, programming, I think, might be the best way. When we did, I'm just trying to remember the show, was it, I think, 118, we covered a 10-line programming competition for various flavors, actually any flavor of BASIC. So I'm going to enter into the 10-line competition, and I am in the process of finishing off my entry. It's a 10-line text adventure program. So, and the additional challenge I've put on myself is not using any go-to or if statements.
Wow.
How that possible?
You do this?
Are you going to poke the program counter or something?
Well, you're only allowed to poke in changes. You're not allowed to actually poke in a machine routines or programs. But the hint I'll give you is that the hero of the story is Prince Boolean.
Yes, okay. I guess you can use a for next loop. That will probably. That I was trying to figure out if this was going to be like you only get one command, and if you get it right, you win, and if you don't, you lose.
Hitchhikers.
So wait, is the 10-line program? Didn't Kevin Savitz enter that once before?
He's entered a few. He's put a few entries in for this time. But yes, he's been in it before, I believe. But
okay. I was just actually making sure that we got his name in.
Yes, Kevin. Yes, you are my inspiration, Kevin. You're right. There's going to be a for next loop in there for the main loop control. Basically, it's every programming trick that I used to use back in the day, so to speak, to get as much code into the 10 lines, because obviously you can stack your commands onto the lines. So I think AppleSoft is restricted to about 230 bytes of program code, so that's to cover all the expansion of tokenized code and whatnot. But of course, if you use a go-to statement, you're breaking out, and you can only go back to the start of a line. So you know you've lost whatever's to the right of the go-to statement. So, everything there. So, short variable names so that the program is more difficult to read, but will fit in. And, the thing I'm currently working on is tokenizing all my text so that I can actually save bytes in. Because obviously you've got to load the data in to run the program. Otherwise, it's a very boring text adventure. No full strings apart from what's in the data load section. So it's quite a fun little project, and I'll post the link up to it once I get my entry completed. I've got to also bundle it up with a emulator so that the judges can run the program, and also give them some, I suppose, a brief guidance on using the program, because as you can imagine, with 10 lines of code, sometimes you've got to sort of like be a little bit stingy on the validation. So,
There's no like hit H for help.
There's definitely no hit H for help. No F1 for help. There is no help. It's a text adventure. Half the fun is figuring out what to do, and then the other half of the fun is actually doing it.
I'm really looking forward to seeing this.
Yeah, no, that sounds pretty cool. I was thinking about the problem with text. Infocom would compress their text into I think it was 5-bit bytes in order to get more on the disk.
Yeah,
but I'm wondering if you can find 10 letters that are dispensable. Maybe you can get this into like maybe you can use only 16 letters in your text.
How about we set the game in the land with no vowels. If that gets rid of follow.
Yes, right.
No, it's been a great little programming exercise. The difficult thing, of course, is actually packing the lines so that you've only got 10 lines, and I'm basically using a full screen text editor on my Apple II at the moment to do the programming, and from that generating the AppleSoft basic lines. And then going in for the final tweak, hand coding it just to use up every single byte that's available to me.
Cool. Good luck.
I think I'm going to need it. I'm currently at about 12 and a half lines, so I'm in the culling stage. You know, what functionality do I take out and still have a usable text adventure?
Oh, neat. Hacking away, get that baby down to, real programmers know how to be efficient.
Well, that's the thing with this. Efficiency is not a requirement. It's just fitting it in. So I'm not worrying about memory utilization, because if I only have to put it all on 10 lines, that definitely brings it under. My target system is a 48K Apple II. I thought I'd try and keep the emulator as basic as possible. So memory utilization's not an issue. Speed was not a requirement. Everything is revolving around getting it to fit on 10 lines.
How cool. All right. Well, yeah, definitely we'll want to see a link to that when that's done. And on my front, I've been chasing a squirrel now for a few weeks. I got some other things to do on my retro computing hobbies, but I've got this FPGA board, and I've been just diving in basically neck deep with FPGA stuff, trying to learn how it works and how it's programmed and what you can do with it. And I'm finding this digital logic design to be really compelling and fun stuff, but definitely time-consuming stuff as I'm learning this, so I might have to break away from that a little bit and get back to some of my retro projects, like the fourth that I was trying to put together for the 128. But boy, this digital logic stuff is fun, though.
So are you having a release date in May for your fourth?
Yeah, maybe not. We'll see what happens. So, you know, putting a stake in the ground, though, sometimes that's a useful thing to do.
Oh, may the fourth be with you.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. All right. Well, I have to say that's it for this show before we squeeze any other bad puns in there. You can find the show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vintage-computer.com/vcforum. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast, and you can join our Facebook group for Retro Computing Roundtable. We'll have a link to that up in the show notes. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We're a member of the Throwback Network, a proud member of that network, where you can find other retro-themed podcasts if you're so inclined, at throwbacknetwork.net. And if you like the show, please write a review for us on iTunes. That way, other like-minded folks can find us. And until next time,
Retro Computes.
See you guys.